That's why we gonna be burning and looting tonight.
Say we gonna burn and loot.
Burning and looting tonight.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Burning and Lootin' by Bob Marley and the Wailers. We celebrate today Bob Marley on this program and all day tomorrow on WEAA. He would have been 70 years old today. Everyone, we're about to have another conversation with one of our frequent guests and dear friend, Dr. Kay Whitehead, who, of course, is Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, and has written a book that we've talked about before, which is Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, and has just now recently published Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in Post-Racial America, that just came out last week. And we are being joined also today by Dr. Myra Young Armstead, who is Professor of History and Director of Africana Studies at Bard College, author of Freedom's Gardener, James F. Brown, Horticulture and the Hudson Valley in Antebellum America, Mighty Change, Tall Within, Black Identity in the Hudson Valley, and Lord, Please Don't Take Me in August, African Americans in Newport with and Saratoga Springs. And great to have you with us, Dr. Armstead.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
And they are joining us because they'll be speaking this Saturday. Both of them will present their books based on diaries by African Americans from the antebellum and Civil War periods. And you can just go to rflewismuseum.org or 443-263-8116 for information to come and join them. It's good to have both of you here at the same time.
Thank you very much.
So let me start this way. Dr. Myra Young Armstead, I've been reading your book a little bit, and I'm really fascinated by this story. But quickly, if you both outline the stories of these two people and how you found them before we leap into the depth of the subject.
Okay. Well, James F. Brown was born in 1793, and he died in 1868. He was born in Maryland. We don't have the exact details of his birth, but he was a slave. And around 1827, actually in 1827, he escaped from Baltimore and made his way to New York City, where he was employed by a wealthy landed gentry family that had an estate on the Hudson Valley. He was discovered by somebody who knew his owner, and when that happened, the Verplank family, that was the family that employed him, helped him broker a deal that freed him. He was able to purchase his manumission over a three-year period, and he became their master gardener and lived the rest of his life with his wife, who he had freed before running away and gone back to Maryland to get in upstate New York. He kept a diary from 1829, 2 years after he escaped, until 1866, which is incredible. And I found the diary when I was visiting Mount Gullion Historic Site, which is the name of the estate that the Verplank family, the family that helped him, that employed him, has on the Hudson Valley, or had. It was in the family. It's now a National Historic Site. So I was there, and I saw this book, and I said, "What is it?" And I was told, "It's the gardener's diary." And by the way, he was African-American. I nearly fainted.
and they allowed you. This is an original, so that you had to go. Did you have to go through a lot of hoops to be able to get to the book?
Actually, no. The director, I couldn't believe it, told me you can take it home with you.
Wow!
But it turned out that they actually had a copy. The original had been in the New York Historical Society records from 1841. The Verplank family had given it to them. They had gotten the diary in 1890 when James's widow died, and apparently she stayed with the family. When she died, the family kept the diary, and then in 1941, they gave the diary to the New York Historical Society. So it's been there. People have used it, but no one had actually thought about the life of its author, which it was amazing to me.
Right. And it is amazing. Not completely surprising.
Yeah.
Given our world. But, yeah. But you know, because I think oftentimes people see these things, and some scholars and some historians and some people who run these institutions, run these old historic sites, would go, well, it was just from an old black guy who was did their garden. What would he have to say? Right.
that's true. And Dr. Whitehead, you probably could concur with this. The diary, in and of itself, isn't that interesting because it doesn't reveal a lot of interiority, what he was thinking, his deepest thoughts, the kinds of things that you would want, you know, the juicy details of his inner life. You have to know how to read silences and be a detective to figure that out. Mm. And that was a huge challenge for me because on the surface, it's very encyclopedic, very terse, and the way scholars had used it was just to verify that, President Polk passed through New York on such and such day because he recorded all that kind of stuff. And he recorded a lot of weather details.
was a gardener.
Right. Exactly. Right.
So how does this correspond to your discoveries? From what I remember, it's a little similar.
It's a little similar. My book, Notes from a Colored Girl, looks at the life of Emily Frances Davis. She was born in 1838. Unlike the gardener, she was born as a free woman in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and she died in 1889 in Philadelphia. So she had this diary that she kept for 3 years. That's all that's been found. I have to say, I've only found 1,095 days. She may have kept it longer. She may have kept it after that. But the exciting thing about her diary is that it goes from 1863 to 1865. So she records every day of her life during the Civil War, which I think is very exciting because we did not have that voice. I call her an everyday free black woman because we know a lot about the elite community. You think of the Charlotte Fortins and the Ida B. Wellses of that time. And we know a lot about the enslaved community. I mean, we talk about enslaved women kind of en masse. It's this huge big blob of women and not individuals other than, of course, Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. And Emily Frances Davis's diary fills in that empty gap, that space that I believe exists between these two communities.
So I this is the important point. A couple of things popped in my head listening to both of you and knowing your book intimately, Kay, and I will get to know your book intimately, Myra Armstead, and get you back on the show just to spend time talking about the book itself. But is that we just described how people can see this as a blob. And what struck me when you said that was, it's how we see this. This is, to me, uncharted American historical waters.
Right.
The waters of what it was like to be black before the Civil War, when slavery was the law and the place of the land, and you were living or attempting to live free.
I think that is, you hit it right on the nail. Because Emily's life really challenges our understanding and the assumptions we make about this time period. When we talk about the period of American enslavement, we tend to lump all the free black people and all the enslaved black people together as if it's one community. Because Emily lived in Philadelphia, which was a very robust free black community, you had people of all different income levels. You had seamstresses, and they were working as domestics, and they were working as waiters. They were actually building a life for themselves. Emily went to school. I mean, it's obvious because she was extremely literate. She talked about pursuing education. She was at the Institute for Colored Youth, which later became Cheney University. So she was actively in pursuit of her own agency. Mm-hmm, and I think that's something we don't really think about when we think of this time period, that the history of every black person in this country does not begin and end with enslavement. There was a very large free black community that we tend to overlook as we try to suss out what happened during that time.
And James F. Brown, the horticulturist who was a slave and has a really interesting story about how he got out of that and how he dealt with it, was not part of the mass. He was very much an individual and lived a life in his own way.
Yeah, very much. I mean, just a sense of proportions, we have to remember that before the Civil War, 90% of African Americans were enslaved.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when we're talking about free blacks, we're talking about the minority yet, when we look at the free blacks, we, as historians, rely heavily on literary sources. So we're looking at the few who kept diaries, and they're the leaders of their community. So, as Dr. Whitehead said, that tends to be the elites. It's exciting when you find someone who is more ordinary and who gives you a glimpse into that life. So James was interesting to me because, you know, I teach U.S. history at Bard. I teach more general mainstream history than African-American history. And for the period that he was born, there's this book that I often used called Inheriting the Revolution, and it's mm-hmm. about the first generation of Americans born after the Revolutionary War ends. Mm-hmm. And it's very much about forging an American identity, the idea of entrepreneurship, self-making. And when I was reading the diary, I kept thinking, wow, James F. Brown fits this story. And yet, in that book, which is a very well-known book, Inheriting the Revolution, an excellent book, mm-hmm. There aren't that many, if any, black illustrations. So I began sort of looking at his life that way, within the strictures that were real for black people, mm-hmm. even free black people. He somehow or another sort of imbibed the mainstream ideas of what was possible. And he achieved an extraordinary amount of success when you consider that he started as a slave. So he escapes, he becomes a waiter in this household in New York, and then he becomes a coachman, and then he becomes a master gardener. So he actually achieves the pinnacle of his craft, his chosen craft, and he becomes part of a very rarefied horticultural community, which was occupied really by gentlemen farmers. And so that's a very exciting story, and you know, it's something that I found, you know, many ordinary African Americans were very much consumed with. You know, how are we going to get ahead, even though that there are these restrictions that we face every day? How are we going to achieve the American dream?
I think that that's a little bit different with Emily, because even though she was part of the minority, when we start looking at the overall numbers of black people in the country at that time, it was the majority in Philadelphia. So because we found her diaries, there's a tendency to make her more extraordinary than perhaps she was at that time. Keeping diaries was not something that was unheard of in the free black literate communities. They were not just keeping diaries, they were keeping these like photo albums, and they were, you know, pressing photos, you know, daguerreotypes at that time. They were putting in flowers and they were passing them up and down the East Coast. So what she was doing was not unusual for her community. What is unusual about it is that it's the only one we've found thus far. I mean, Emily is part of a very small number of primary sources that we've found written by free black women during that time period. So I had to make sure in trying to uncover her life that I did as much as I could to not make her extraordinary, to really allow the ordinariness of her life to come forward, because then I think people could relate to it better, that she lived a daily, everyday existence where she went to work. She was a trained seamstress, which is something she learned from her mom. So that is a skill set that was very valued at that time. At the same time, when she could not make dresses to make money, then she worked as a domestic. I mean, she's one of the women that we know about who bought a Singer sewing machine on the Singer land lease program, that she actually was trying to buy property, and she was trying to find a way to claim her own space. She finished writing her diaries, or she completed the ones we have found, at the end of 1865, with this idea that, you know, some Confederate villain has killed my beloved president. And from then, we don't find any more of her own words. We do find her in history. We found her marriage certificate. So we do know that she married into one of the most wealthiest black families in the community, the White family. We find her name mentioned in the records for her church, First African Presbyterian. She bought her own seat in the church, and she kept her seat and eventually gave it to her daughter that she was named after. So she made her own way, but I think that the tendency to make her more extraordinary than she was at that time really undercuts the richness of that community.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to, I hear that, it's difficult to describe ordinariness versus extraordinariness in these cases, because there are times in the book where I talk about James as being extraordinary in being ordinary. Mm-hmm. I definitely agree that there's a way in which when you look very carefully at his activities, you get a window into what other ordinary, less well-known, less elite black people were doing. He, for example, was also head man of the estate, and he mentions other people, who a lot of black workers who he hired from time to time seasonally. And when you start tracing out what they were doing, their work rhythms, when they came on the farm, when they left, when he gave them excuses to take time off, you do get this very detailed and very invigorated picture of ordinary rhythms of black life. Somebody dies. He spearheads a funeral, a cemetery building campaign for the black community. So there's a way in which you do get a sense of what is ordinary. But in James's case, I think that his connections, because he was connected to a very wealthy family, a very socially prominent family, mm-hmm. that included politicians, he had a kind of extraordinary favor that he benefited from. Mm-hmm. So he was able to serve as a liaison and a broker on behalf of the black community. For example, in New York State, after 1821, it became impossible for black men to vote unless they owned $250 worth of property.
Hmm.
At the same time, mm-hmm. the same state legislature, in a special constitutional convention, eliminated all property qualifications for white men. What James did was use his connections with wealthy landowners who were sympathetic to blacks to help his friends buy property. So there's a section of the diary where you see names mentioned, and then you go to the tax records and you find that these people are negotiating and buying land all around the same time in the same community, and James is at the center of it. They live in New York City, but they have land here. There's an upstate Gerrit Smith, a big name in northeastern abolitionist history, mm-hmm. owns a lot of land upstate, and he gives land away to in some cases, poor people, but black people in the Adirondacks. John Brown is part of that mm-hmm. community for a while. And James is corresponding with him. So in those ways, he's extraordinary, right. But he is acting on behalf of the majority of free blacks who have the same aspirations he does.
So you just said that James F. Brown was corresponding with John Brown, the abolitionist.
No, he's corresponding with Gerrit Smith. Gerrit Smith. And Gerrit Smith, up in New York State, there's a community called Timbuktu and others that consist of landowners who are free blacks. And these are small communities, but for a while, John Brown lived up there.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So this world, did you want to say to me, okay, before question?
I just want to say that one of the things, when you look at the differences in the diary writing styles of males and females, which I talk about in my book, this public and private space, Emily may have done very extraordinary things. She did not record them in her diary. She talked about buying clothes. She talked about cutting her hair. She talked about the number of male suitors that were in her life. She did not talk a lot about what was happening outside of her own life. That this was, I felt, a very private space. So maybe she was extraordinary. Maybe she did do wonderful and great things. I have not found any record of that. And I know that in her diary, when I read through those days, what I get is this daily repetition, which I think is very interesting, which is what I wanted to explore. What does it mean to live out your daily life in the spirit and in this feeling where there's a war going on, but it doesn't impact you until your brother goes off to war? That's the only time she began to talk about the Civil War, was when her brother was being drafted and trying to run away and make his way up to Canada because he did not want to join the armed services. Well, that's an interesting story in and of itself, but that's her brother's story. Because all Emily records is we can't find him, and then he gets caught and comes back. So that idea of being kind of a historical detective is the work you have to do to put some meat around these bones that Emily kind of pulls out.
Absolutely. That, you know, that's the thing with these kinds of diaries. I totally agree with that because, you know, all of this information that I just shared about James is not in his diary.
Right.
Right, right.
So it's frustrating. I find it fascinating that this woman kept her diary during the Civil War, because my huge, huge disappointment was that James almost drops the pen entirely during the Civil War. The diary ends in 66. Now, he's getting old.
Right.
And, you know, remember, he's been a gardener, and there's all sorts of stuff in the diary about sprained backs and lame eyes. And, you know, he's, you know, maybe he just can't write anymore. Right. But I think that he just didn't know how to write about the Civil War.
Okay.
And that has to do with, you know, the politics of respectability that I think a lot of free northern blacks who had the patronage of sympathetic whites struggled with. Certainly the elites were practitioners of a politics of respectability, and I think he was really torn. Also, in James's case, his benefactor, the family that he was working for, had a very strange position on the Civil War. Julian Verplank, who was the son of the man who manumitted him, was a kind of anti-slavery Democrat, which was a very difficult position.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then at the same time, his son, Robert Verplank, goes to war and leads a U.S. colored troops regiment. So within the family, I don't think there were tensions, but
right.
It would be hard to know how to write about this. And I think there's one entry where he talks about a group of volunteers from the local community catching the train. But he says nothing. I mean, nothing about the Emancipation Proclamation, nothing about Lincoln's assassination.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Nothing.
Okay.
And I argue that literally you can see where he is, because the diary at that point during the war is filled with calamities. You know, it's just filled with it's almost apocalyptic. There's a fire. The winter is the worst winter ever, and this person died, and he's just recording death after death. But these are civilian deaths, and I think that's a kind of a kind of mirror into what was going on within him. You know, it lets us see how difficult and hard it was for him to countenance the country going through this, although clearly he supported an end to slavery.
Because despite his misgivings and not wanting to break the law, he left when they wouldn't free him, so...
Right.
Oh, yeah, but that letter, oh, my, that's the tantalizing thing there. See, I found a letter which has been known as a source about slavery, written by someone named Anthony Chase, and it's in the Maryland State Archives, part of the Williams family papers, and the Williams family is the family that he ran away from. And I was able to prove that this Anthony Chase was James F. Brown. And it's very clear that he was James F. Brown.
Good detective
work. In that letter,
yeah.
he's tortured about, I mean, not tortured, but he's conflicted about leaving. He apologizes. So sorry, I tried to work it out with you, but, you know, after 2 or 3 years, you're not seeing, you know, reason, and so I'm going to leave. I'll pay you back.
That's great detective work there.
I'll pay you back. I think that the more this period of time is unraveled, and this free black culture is unraveled in this country. I mean, it ached me every time I hear something new. It talks about the complexity of just individuals and people and community, mm-hmm. that everybody was very different, had different, you know, different ways they addressed what they were facing in terms of slavery.
Right.
They all had to live through the Fugitive Slave Act period, right. and how they responded to that, and the class differences.
Right.
I mean, there is something about when you read about people like James F. Brown or about the people you wrote about, Kay, there is... Let me just pause at this and see what you think. I was curious how this relates to where we are today in some ways. Mm-hmm. One thing I keep thinking about is that the black middle class, I'm talking about from the 19th century on black middle mm-hmm. class, and many of whom were descended from people who fled and became free or right. were free before right. the Civil War, is one of the kind of the most cultured, polite societies. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
And there's some roots to this about having been enslaved and creating a different world
right.
that really went into the century.
Right. I think it's what we were talking about, this idea of a politics of respectability, the creating this very polite society that's even more polite. I mean, it's almost as if, you know, here's a society that enslaved us, so because enslaved people who look like us, but because we are free, we're going to be even more polite. We're going to be more cultured. We're going to be more respectable than the culture that we are in opposition to. I mean, I see that in Emily's diary. I see that in Emily's life as I filled in the blank spaces, that this space that she created was a very respectable and cultured space. When they met each other on the street, they would speak in Spanish or in French or in Latin or in German, depending upon who was around. Sometimes they would mix all the languages together if they were in, you know, a white environment and they wanted to speak to another black person. In code was a way that she would talk about this, but it was a respectable culture. And you saw that coming into the 19th century and beyond. What does it mean to create this space where we position ourselves as if we have arrived, whatever arrived means, but that we are different than those who have not arrived? One of the things that I pull out in this book, that there was a great distinction in Philadelphia between this kind of elite and mulatto community and this formerly enslaved black community.
Yeah.
Emily calls herself, I mean, she racially self-identifies once in the book, and she calls herself colored. I mean, hence the title, Notes from a Colored Girl. But on the U.S. Census, she is noted as a mulatto woman. She's mulatto, her mother's mulatto, her sister's mulatto. And what's interesting is that skin color that allowed her access into First African Presbyterian Church, which was a mulatto church. And that was part of like almost a membership badge. I mean, Institute for Colored Youth had a number of mulatto students. So even though she doesn't talk about that, that skin color did kind of affect the way she moved through. What I don't know, and I guess this is a story that still needs to be told, is Emily created a life for herself in her diary. What I wonder is all the other times when she's at a lecture by Frederick Douglass, or she's at a meeting at the home of William Still and Frederick Douglass shows up, those are the records I don't have. What was talked about in those meetings? She's sitting there, she's quiet, she has her diary, and instead of talking about what Frederick Douglass said that night, she comments on what people were wearing. Like, she really kept making everything about herself. And maybe that's one of the lessons from her diary. This is what I teach my students. Emily shows us the importance of telling your own story. Emily's name has survived to today because her work has survived. That this is a record that she has created for herself that we can now pull from and begin to understand at least a different story to that community. It may not be the whole story, because Emily cannot stand for every woman at that time, but it's at least a piece of the story that begins to fill that gap that I was talking about.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, it's sort of fascinating that she doesn't mention what we would expect her to mention at a Frederick Douglass lecture, even though she may have been thinking about it. And, you know, I definitely concur, the Institute for Colored Youth, Octavius Caddo, and that whole elite black circle is fascinating. They do carry over, as you say, Mark, into what Willard Gatewood calls the aristocrats of color, you know, into the 20th century.
Right.
And, mm-hmm. and you know, we still have vestiges
right.
of it.
Right.
So far as sort of having more than one voice or more than one perspective, having one's own opinion. In terms of James Brown, one of the things that I find fascinating is that while he is a very moderate, temperate man, and I argue that he deliberately cultivates that sense of moderation as part of the politics of respectability. Every once in a while, you'll hear another voice that'll come out, and that happens. Yeah, it happens increasingly after the 1850s, and it's you know, again, reading between the lines.
Right.
So when John Brown is executed, he has one line, because, you know, the diary tends to be very terse about these things, and he refers to John Brown, our hero. John Brown, our hero. Now, you know, that's very interesting for a very temperate man. And then we see him going to, recording that he's going to Emancipation Day celebrations. At that point, Emancipation Day celebrations for blacks before the Civil War were celebrations of West Indian emancipation. But he begins to mention this. So we begin to see after the Compromise of 1850, and when things really heat up, we begin to see more explicit kinds of political statements that make us know where he's going. And, you know, it's in this period, for instance, that he spearheads this successful effort to get a separate black burial ground in his community. Yeah, it's sort of fascinating to see this multivocality, I would say, in these people, the complexity of their experience and their consciousness and their perspective
on
what's going on.
This is fascinating, and I'm really so happy that the two of you agreed to join us here for this conversation.
Thank you.
There's so much more to talk about here, and I think this is a very critically important piece of our history that has to be on the table to wrestle with where we are today and what this society means and who these people were and why they were. And you can meet these two incredible women and their conversation this Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. They will both be there with their books, and you have a chance to really dialogue about this. You can get information at rflewismuseum.org or 443-263-1816. That will all be also at steinershow.org. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On our way to a very brief break, we're hearing Rebel Music, Bob Marley and the Wailers. He would have been 70 years old today.